Sup, fools? This is the QTR Podcast. Today is June 19th, 2018, and I was away on an extended vacation for the last week and a half, which is why I have pretty much fallen off the face of the earth. People have been asking me when I'm going to do a podcast again, and that day is today. And I have with me a previous guest who I decided to bring back on and allow to take a victory lap here for his recent purchase in Tesla, which has been a topic that we have talked about more than once on this podcast. And also yesterday I was getting over a cold, so I plan on coming back and doing a little rant podcast. That's going to have to wait until I have something good to rant about. Anyways, I have Ross Gerber on the line. Last time he was on, I had him on with Adam Spittler trying to do a little bull bear debate, which went pretty good, even though I think Ross dominated most of the conversation. So I figured this time I'd just fucking bring him on by himself. Anyways, for those of you that don't know Ross, he's co-founder, president, and CEO of Gerber Kawasaki Wealth and Investment Management. He oversees Gerber Kawasaki's corporate and investment management operations, as well as serves individual clients. You may have seen him on CNN, CNBC, FBN, Bloomberg, Reuters. And he's got a lot of Twitter followers and Facebook fans. Twitter in your bio online, Ross, is lowercase. You have to capitalize that. So you can put your assistant on that or whoever answered the phone.
Yeah, actually, I've got to work on that bio a little bit.
Anyways, hey, look, I guess we will start by saying it's cool to have you back on. I wrote this on Twitter the other day. However you feel about your investment thesis in any number of companies that I disagree with you on, one of which is Tesla, another one is Trupanion, which I think maybe we could do another podcast.
Oh, on. That's at an all-time high, too.
I know. But regardless of how you feel about that, I got to give you props for going in and buying Tesla in the mid-240s, high 240s. You've obviously made money on that investment, and money talks, bullshit walks. And the other thing I will give you props on before we get started is you are a respectable person to deal with. I find you very pleasant to deal with, and I know that people take a lot of shots at you online and on Twitter and shit. And I will give you an immense amount of credit for just kind of how I don't really know how you do it, but whether it's you just ignore it or you just don't give a fuck. But the fact that you're able to kind of put your head down and bludgeon your way through that, I'll give you credit for that as well. So do you have an opening statement you'd like to make other than I told you so for right now?
Well, I mean, I wanted to thank you first and foremost for having me on, and I would say the same about you. Very respectable, smart guy, and I do find intelligent conversation with disagreement to be the best way to find good investments, especially when people are very much thinking differently than myself. So I actually enjoy that, and sorry for dominating the conversation last time. I tend to do that, so just stop me.
Oh, I will. I will. Well, it's just me and you this time. So,
but especially about topics I'm passionate about. It's a challenge to keep myself in line, especially things like Tesla. Trupanion, I'm less passionate about, but I am very into the dog business. But going backwards, the bottom line has been a really, really profitable period of time the last 2 months for me and my firm. Not just Tesla coming back, which is a top holding of ours, but also huge rally in a lot of the stocks that we own across the board. So
what else do you own?
Well, as far as seeing the big moves, we have a decent position in Netflix, which is doubled this year. I mean, it's kind of crazy. Talk about a stock that's overvalued. We have a decent. It is, but yeah. I mean, what am I going to do? I'm long.
What are you going to do? That's the question.
I'm not going to do anything with it.
Well, you're telling me that you're long, and you're telling me it's overvalued, and so do you put that one together with the other, and does any light bulb go off and say maybe I should sell it?
Well, it's interesting because we used to be a little bit more trim in this and trim that when we made money. And, I had a wonderful dinner with Ron Barron, who's a major Tesla shareholder, and we had a long talk. He's a billionaire investor, a really cool opportunity to just kind of sit and learn from somebody. And one of the things that kind of caught my attention in our conversation was the idea of, you know, stop fiddling with your positions. You know, just if you're long Netflix, and just hold it because your premise hasn't changed. And, you know, taking profits along the way, it's basically giving up future profits.
Well, your premise ostensibly would have changed if you were buying it because you thought that it was valued at a discount relative to cash that it's going to earn in the future, or the size it's going to get in the future. And now you're admitting that it's overvalued. You know, I mean, only probably one in every 10 or one in every 20, I don't know what it is, long positions are going to be good enough to buy and hold forever. I mean, a lot of companies, they have, you know, periods where they do fantastic and then they pull back, they correct,
right,
they either, you know. So when you tell me it's overvalued, but then you say you don't want to sell it, are you going to be surprised if it gets cut in half, cut in by
33%? Well, right. I mean, in theory, that's the risk. And so I would say we would have a discipline if the stock started cratering to you know, maybe, you know, take profits at that time. But, you know, once again, you know, we've taken profits in Netflix in the past, and it seems like now that was a bad idea. But, you know, that being said, Tesla is a much bigger position for us than Netflix. Nvidia is another holding of ours that's done very well. Is a much bigger position than Netflix for us. You know, several of our top holdings are. One of our holdings is which I don't think is suspended. Control 4 is a small cap.
Okay.
We own Northrop as a top holding, and Apple and Disney.
Okay.
And Activision. So when you talk about overvalued stocks or stocks that short sellers are interested, like Netflix or Tesla, you know, we offset that risk by having low PE stocks like Apple and Disney in our top 10.
So you'll hold Netflix even though you think it's overvalued until the momentum runs out, essentially, is what you're saying?
Exactly. I mean, well, think about the momentum in a stock like Netflix. I mean, it's up 15 points today. I mean, you know, why? You know?
Yeah, that's a great question.
You know, I literally watch show after show that's phenomenally well done on Netflix. But, you know, was there some surge in subscribers this week? I don't know. But, you know, when you look at a traditional media company like Disney relative to Netflix, you know, it's almost a no-brainer to buy Disney over Netflix.
Well,
but we own both. And so we have, you know, we have to say to ourselves as investors, you know, if I'm going to make some sort of call on a valuation, you know, the market can, you know, and this is what I think people like on your podcast can learn from, is you might be right in theory, but if the market's working against you, it's a very painful thing to be right and broke.
Well,
you know what I mean?
That's very true. That's a very good point.
And so one thing I've learned over the years is it's not really what I think, it's what the market's doing. And the market doesn't give a fuck about me, you know, and it will run me over. And that's what I think the Tesla shorts have to be worried about right now, because there's no way that I predicted that Tesla would go up 100 points from our last conversation. You know what I mean? That is the best possible outcome that I could have possibly dreamed of in the last month. I certainly didn't expect that so quickly, or I would have bought more. But you know, now I'm a little bitter because I can't buy more now. You know, it's moved a little bit away from me. But you know, nevertheless, you can't fight the market. And this is a bull market. And that's what I think a lot of short sellers have to also understand, is it doesn't matter what the stock is. When you're in a bull market, you know, you can get railroaded even being right. And I'll give you a period of time that you may or may not have been alive as an investor during, was 99. So in 99, that was Y2K was coming around, and people were getting really scared. And from the middle of 99 to the end of 99, I think it was, it was 99, the market doubled in value. The NASDAQ literally doubled. And I remember really clearly thinking the market was overvalued, and then it doubled. You know what I mean? And that was the blow-off peak before the decline. But, you know, if you miss that, you know, you're missing a lot.
So how? Yeah. So here's two questions for you. First, how are you valuing Netflix? Do you value it on an earnings basis? Do you value it on a sales basis? I mean, it looks pretty frothy across the board. 88 times forward earnings, 13 times sales, you know, EV to sales of 13, EV to EBITDA of 157 trailing 12 month, $175 billion market cap. You have new content creators basically coming out of anywhere and everywhere. So my first question...
Well, they're also vastly overpaying for talent, too.
Well, yeah, they're spending a shitload of money on content because right now it's this race for content. But aren't you concerned by the influx of content creators? I mean, you could make the argument, and probably we would both agree on this, me as a skeptic of Netflix and you as a bull, that they have never faced as much the competitive headwinds right now are the strongest they've ever been for Netflix.
I just did an interview saying that, like, literally an hour ago. You're absolutely right. There's never been more players with more money and new players with a lot of money that are going to take Netflix on. But by the end of my conversation, I would convince myself that nobody's going to give up Netflix for Disney or for another app. They might add it on to Netflix, but they're not going to give up Netflix.
Well, I don't know if that's true. What is Netflix bringing in terms of original content, with the exception of, I don't know, Stranger Things and a couple comedy specials that's
going to
keep
you know, listen, we do a lot of polling. We talk to a lot of people, you know, a lot of young people, and 100% of them have Netflix, and 100% of them aren't on cable. So for them, it's a value add. They're saving $200 a month, and they're spending 15 or 10. So it's a value add, because Netflix is basically the same as cable in my mind.
But from a saturation perspective, shouldn't that concern you?
Well, I think they're fully saturated almost in the U.S. The only people who don't watch Netflix are actually the only people who don't pay for Netflix are the ones stealing their parents' Netflix thing. You know, so I think that's the biggest issue with Netflix, is getting kids to pay for it who are stealing it. But when you talk international, their growth path could be another, you know, 50 to 100 million users pretty easily over the next 5 years. And so I think that's what you have to be concerned about. But then when they mention the word gaming in anything, because we all know the future of a lot of social media and entertainment is in the gaming industry, video gaming.
That I agree with you on.
And when you look at Amazon's Twitch as success, and then you look at platforms like video gaming platforms like Steam or whatever, you know, there's no reason why Netflix couldn't be a video gaming platform and cut a deal with Fortnite, and boom, you know, this thing goes up another 100 points.
So what? Yeah, but how do you reconcile the valuation with?
So valuation, when there isn't really a good metric like for earnings, is I just do price to sales. You know, a lot of businesses you can easily value price to sales, especially if there's a lot of weird accounting in them too, like, you know, like a cable company like Comcast. You know, it's a cheap stock right now, and you can look at a lot of different metrics, but earnings is probably not the best metric, especially in high depreciation companies and things like that. Price to sales is one metric. It's not the best metric. So that's the only metric you can really use with Netflix that you can come up with some sort of like comparable thing. And it's kind of the same metric I use with Tesla, as well as with a company like Spotify, or a company like we own some Shopify. You know, Shopify trades at like 20 times sales. I mean, it's kind of crazy. It keeps going up as well.
So what comps do you use for Netflix?
So Netflix is in kind of its own world. It's, you know, trading, what, 12, 13 times revenue. Even though revenue is growing consistent 30%, you know, I typically don't like paying more than 10 times sales for the most aggressive businesses. And so, you know, in my industry, companies are valued at like 3 times sales, you know. And I think most companies are valued between 3 and 4 times sales. And when you get to 5, it's getting expensive. It's probably a really good growth company. So when you're talking 10, you're talking like one, like an internet startup, where it's hard to really value, but growth is going like 100% a year. So Netflix is, you know, by any metric, ridiculously expensive. And, you know, certainly to take profits here would not be a dumb idea. Maybe I'm talking myself into it right now.
Well, what does Ross need to see to take profits?
Well, I think the biggest issue for me is where that balance is in the portfolio, true valuations. Because Netflix wasn't like a huge position for us, I don't feel as compelled where, you know, other companies we own a lot of, I would probably take some off the top just to keep the portfolios in balance. Mm. But the problem is when we go out, remember, we deal with humans. So when we sell a stock like Netflix, now I got to go talk to the client and ask them, they ask me why I'm so dumb, you know, and so they go, why are you selling my Netflix, you know? And I say, well, the valuation's high, I hear all the metrics, and they'll be like, it's all we watch every day, and you're selling it. You know,
yeah, but on the other hand, you're the money manager, you know, and
right,
and
exactly. But we still have to talk to them, you know, and you know, I think that's the challenge.
So
in
what,
doing what we do,
what do you need to see here to put take your clients out? So first off, what position, what weighting did you have the position on?
Well, let's say for us it was around a 2% position for
okay.
us. So if it grow, it's doubled, now it's a 4% position, we're going to pare that back maybe to 3.
Right.
You know, a lot of times we'll keep the positions just in balance at 2. You know, like Tesla, to me, is actually a much higher risk stock than Netflix as far as execution risk. And so, you know, like a Tesla, I don't want that to be like 5% of somebody's portfolio because, you know, their volatility might kill somebody. You know what I mean?
So what do you need to see to get out of Netflix? What needs to
completely?
Happen? What needs to happen tomorrow for Netflix, which you just said to me now, is completely overvalued. It's trading at a price to sales ratio that's, you know, higher than you would want to pay for it, and is facing competitive headwinds the likes of which it has never seen before. What does it take to set off the alarm at your desk and tell your traders to take it off or to reduce it to a nominal size position?
I think if I saw a fundamental change in the business strategy, or if like Ted Sandros left, you know, it would take a lot. I kind of think the market is making choices. Like, it's saying that we would rather own highly valued, highly overpriced stocks like Netflix than highly cheap, highly beat up companies like GE, because the future is going to be really, really tough for GE, and the future for Netflix looks pretty damn bright. So they're paying higher and higher premiums, you know, very much like the 90s. You know, this is very much like the 90s markets in so many parallels now, especially with things like Bitcoin and crypto and ICOs reminding me very much of the frothy part of the market. And then, you know, you're seeing these kind of stocks that are like, you know, these dominant players where nobody really doesn't want to own these stocks. We see accounts and we go, oh, your advisor didn't buy you Netflix, your advisor didn't buy you Google, your advisor, you know, it's like, what are they doing? You know? And everybody's like, I don't know.
Maybe they're looking at the valuation.
right. But the problem is that the clients are seeing the gains and they're not getting it. And we're taking those clients from those firms, you know.
But doesn't that concern you, though, as a money manager, that at some point in the future, if the tide kind of goes out and we, you know, quote unquote, see who's swimming naked, that the same clients that came to you with the expectation that you're going to put them into a bunch of momentum stocks that don't have cash flow and don't have the valuation to back them up, that those same clients in, you know, at a time where the market starts to correct or interest rates keep rising and all of a sudden the, you know, cheap money starts to dry up and the market
right.
does not extend the confidence to these companies that it has now, that at the very same time, you know, it's going to be a huge negative for your client base.
Right. And so I think the issue that we face, as I did in the 90s, as the market went up and I said the valuations are high, and then the S&P went up another 20%, and I said the valuations are really high, and then the S&P went up another 20%, and then I was like, wow, this is ridiculous, and then went up another 20%, and then I was like, okay, this is fucking crazy, and then it went up another 20%. You know what I'm saying? It was 5 years in a row.
Yeah, I know.
So
what I know exactly
what
you're saying.
I like to tell people is we don't get to determine what changes from the bull mentality to the bear mentality. And it could be a lot of different things, you know. And we spend a lot of time looking for that change. And we're never going to time it right, you know, because market timing is, you know, not a thing that's real. But what we can do is limit the losses when it turns.
Right.
So the key thing is, when does it turn? How do we know what causes markets to turn? And what are the key factors, like setting in stop loss orders in essence of saying, well, Netflix at $350, I'm out. Okay, so it's $405 today. At $350, I'm out. I'm selling half my position. So if Netflix drops 15% or 10% from here, I'm out. You know, and once you kind of say this is the limit and you make it a rule in your portfolio, you can always protect against losses. So, you know, by setting in rules that are sort of irrelevant, you know, you look at the charts and you say this, like the Netflix chart is like super extended, you know, and I'll look at my charts and I'll say, okay, this number is my drop dead number. Because this was something I learned in the financial crisis was, you know, when things break down lower, like past a really strong resistance point, like you can like mentally try to say, oh, it's going to bounce back or whatever. But if sentiment changes and things are breaking down, you just have rules. Because your mind will tell you, oh, it's not ending. Oh, the good times will last forever. But you have to have rules. And I think that's what makes good investors, people who are really have processes to take their emotions out of the decision making. So there is a price at Netflix that I'm going to sell it at, but it's only if it's dropping and the sentiment has changed. And today felt kind of like a sentiment change in a little bit. You know, really, you know, you really feel this down feeling about America and trade and the horrible government we have, and you go, geez, you know. But you know, then the market kind of recovers, and you're like, you know, there's so much, you know, Trump is such a money focused president, and he's given such a gift to the stock market with tax reform. It's hard not to be a bull. And you know, I think as we move forward, we're going to have to look for these signs if the market turns. But there are many frothy stocks that could easily be cut in half.
So what about the prospect of holding something like Netflix through an earnings report where, you know, a bad quarter has the possibility for the stock to gap down, you know, 25% or 30% when the valuation extends as far away from the fundamentals as it has in a company like a Tesla or like a Netflix, whatever. Do you take into account what could possibly happen if the company, you know, reports a terrible quarter and it opens at 300 instead of 350, so you don't have a chance to blow out your stops?
And it's worse for me because they'll put me on CNBC during earnings for Netflix, and I'm sitting there with the same guy I've been beating up for 3.5 years as it's gone up, and they're just waiting for this thing to miss on earnings so they can beat me up. You know, so, you know, every earnings I'm sitting there sweating, going, come on, Netflix, baby, you know, do 6 million people so I don't, you know, have to deal with a 30-point drop after hours. And they've just delivered and delivered and delivered. And, you know, so, you know, I think we're talking about a stock where there's a lot of risk. I really think there is. As great of a business as it is, I think it's a 6 or 7 times revenue business. And even if you give them $20 million, you're still, you know, 10-20% overvalued.
Well, that's, I mean, if you're telling me it's a 7 times revenue business, you're overpaying for it right now by 50%.
Yeah. But we're not buying Netflix right now. Well, we're talking about selling.
So in other words, it's valued 50% higher than it should be, is what you're telling me.
Yeah, totally.
But you're not compelled to take the position off just because of the momentum.
Not with Donnie Trump pumping money into, you know, the market constantly.
How's he pumping?
You know, this is a bull market. You know, it's a bull market.
You're right about that.
And that's like, okay, so like short selling in a bull market is like trying to be celibate in a whorehouse.
Well, I'm talking about managing the position and
right, or even selling. You know, it's like, you know, you've got to pick. It's a winner for you. If I take Netflix out of my portfolio, I lose one of my biggest winners. So the thing's on fire right now.
Well, you don't lose it. You've already made 100% on it or whatever you made on
it. That's true. You know, maybe I'll sell some tomorrow. You know, I don't know.
So I've talked you into selling Netflix in the first 24 minutes of this podcast. Is that what happened?
Yeah, you know, you and me talking enough is making me nervous. because, you know, I mean, even looking at the chart, I mean, it's crazy.
Stop looking at charts. Don't look at charts.
So yeah, you know, maybe I take a few bucks off the table.
How much technical analysis drives your buy and sell decisions?
Actually, very little.
Good.
You know, I think what it does is it's like a reinforcer. I don't want to deny the value of charting. It's very valuable, but I look at it as kind of like a lagging indicator. You know,
well, that's what it is.
Right. But what charting really helps you with are those like resistance points and those sell points, you know, like,
right.
You know, is the stock really breaking out or not? You know, is this breaking below a resistance level? You know, I do look at the moving averages. So it's part of the analysis, and I don't think you should undervalue that part. But in the end, I'm looking at companies, I'm looking at profits, growth, growth in revenue, fundamental analysis is ultimately where I start.
So walk me through. So I just want to tell you, I agree with you on technical analysis. It's not a, personally, I don't think it's a way to make any type of investment decisions, but I do think using it from a supplemental perspective to see maybe where there may be support or where there may be resistance or, you know, basic things like that. I mean, obviously at big round numbers, you're going to hit support and resistance and shit like that. And when you're brushing up against all-time highs or all-time lows, you know. So
And there's a lot of computer trading now, so they use right. these things in making their decisions. So if we're going to outsmart the computers, we've got to know where they're set.
Look at that.
And that actually makes it easier to be a human trader.
So walk me through, I bring a stock to Ross Garber's desk tomorrow, and I give you the income statement, the cash flow statement, and the balance sheet, and I give you the pitch. What is, from the bottom up, your investment process? What do you look for?
Well, the first thing I look for the theme. You know, we talked a little bit about this with Tesla. You know, why are you coming in here with this stock in the first place? Like, what's the theme? You know, you just like Dave and Buster's right now? I mean, is the theme casual gaming dining? Or, you know, I don't know if that's the future. You know, so what's the theme is the first thing. Like Trupanion. One of our themes at our firm is that people are crazy about their pets. They've lost their frickin' mind. Now, in Santa Monica, California, people literally treat pets better than human beings. They will literally walk by a starving homeless person while feeding their dog, Blue Buffalo, while strolling it because the dog's legs might be tired. Okay, so I got disgusted by this, and I decided that people were ridiculous. We started doing some research, and what we found was that the pet industry is exploding. And so, you know, we went to our team of dog lovers and we said, what companies should we own? You know, and we make a list of, you know, the top 10, let's say, companies that are related to pet healthcare or pet care. And then we go through the fundamentals.
Yeah, but isn't Trupanion an insurance company, really, at its...
It is. It's an insurance company. But the reason that we came, you know, we love IDEX, great stock, but it was trading at 60 PE. So we just owned a little, you know, we like Zoetis, but it wasn't quite what we wanted because it had like horses and stuff in there. And some of the other businesses, the first business we bought was VCA Hospitals, which, you know, the cost of healthcare for your dog is outrageous, actually. And so we bought VCA Hospitals, and by the time we were done buying it, I actually got in trouble because I hadn't even really bought it yet fully, and I bought 1,000 shares for my mom, and then the next day it got acquired. So sure enough, I get this call from compliance, you know. It's like, oh, insider.
Why are you buying for your mother before
right.
before you're buying for your clients?
Right before it gets acquired. And I was like, it's called luck, you know. And so, you know, obviously it was lucky, so there wasn't much there.
Yeah, but wait. Back up. You were going to buy it for your clients, but you bought it for your mother first?
No. We had bought it for our clients.
Oh, you had already bought it for your clients.
And we have to buy for us last.
Right.
So I can't buy any stock until I finish buying the position. So the last trade was my mom, but the next day it got acquired, you know,
right.
It was like, how did you do this? You know, and I was like, it's lucky. I've been buying for months. It was just, you know, my mom was the last trade cause I had to buy it for everybody else, you know?
So let's go back to Trupanion real quick.
So we do the fundamentals and we buy VCA, we sell it, we make money. So then we look for the next one. And then I met with this guy who owns a dog business. He works for with a company called ABX, which makes a lot of like stuff. Like they were making like stents for dog hearts and like valves for dog aortas. And I'm like, dude, it's a dog. It's sick. Just put it down. And they're like, they don't do that anymore. You know, people try to keep their dogs alive, and we're making medical products for every possible disease a dog has. So I was like, this is insane. So then I did some research into like the life expectancy of dogs and the healthcare costs of dogs, and dogs don't live that long, and they all get pretty sick. And I was like, dude, if you don't have dog health insurance, you're a stupid idiot, because it costs like literally more money than the dog to do basic stuff, right? So So we started looking at these solutions, and Trupanion was a tech solution. You go onto the app, it's pitched by the vet.
Yeah, but it's an insurance company. It's not a tech company.
Right. So they collect all this money. They have a cap.
Okay, wait. Most insurance companies are valued on what metric?
Well, insurance companies have a float, and typical insurance companies, so it could be a lot of different metrics, but you can't compare it to, like, you know, Aetna.
Well, you can, because it's at its core, it's doing the same thing, right? They're collecting premiums.
This is where I disagree. Only 4% of people insure their dogs. And Trupanion's growth rate is 30%.
Yeah, but
revenue.
That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about
But
at the end of the day, they're collecting premiums and they're issuing payouts, right?
Right, right.
So they're an insurance company.
They are an insurance company, but okay, it's not a traditional insurance company.
Well, it's not in the sense that it trades at 25 times its book value, which is unheard of for an insurance company.
They don't have a float, but like. But it's also
Wait a second. Hold on. What does having a float have to do with trading at 25 times book?
Well, because your book value is being built by your float and the returns on your float. So a book value metric makes a lot more sense for an AIG than it does for a Trupanion.
You're talking about its float in you mean float in terms of its shares that are outstanding and aren't held.
No, I'm talking about the float, like the capital that they hold that they earn interest on.
Okay,
that's like the whole reason to own an insurance.
Oh, that goes to show you what I don't know about insurance companies.
Well, you know, we do a lot of business with insurance companies, so I know them pretty well. And so the whole purpose of having insurance companies, people pay you premiums, and you hold the premiums. And you hope your loss ratio is at best equal or even underwriting gain, ideally. And then you hold that float and you invest it. And that return on that float is really your big return in being an insurance company. So the better you are at investing, the better insurance company you have, hence Berkshire Hathaway.
So how does Trupanion's return on their float compare to the peers?
They don't really have one. That's my point. And so, like, Trupanion's like a growth company that's trying to make an underwriting profit and grow revenues at a very quick pace to offset any losses they have, so that they can build a float eventually and sort of build the company. It's a
isn't
small
that
company.
Like a little Ponzi-ish, though?
No, that's how insurance works.
Oh, right.
Insurance is a pooling investors' dollars together to protect against a risk.
Right.
And so that's all they're doing. So this is a billion-dollar company. You know, it's not a big company. So, you know, they just – it's in the growth stage of gathering premiums. I think the risk with Trupanion is what's the cost of the loss versus the premium they're charging, and, you know, are they going to see greater losses because they're spending more and more money on dogs. But, you know, for the customer, it's a wonderful product because people are getting stuck with $5,000 vet bills they can't afford, and they're filing bankruptcy now.
Oh, well, for the customer, it might be a fantastic product. But, I mean, from an investment standpoint, what's the one metric that you guys are valuing it on internally? So if there's no return on this float to compare it to peers, and it's trading at 25 times book and 500 times earnings estimates.
Well, we're not using book. I mean, we're looking at, you know, if you look at their revenue – is very, very fast growing. You know, just in the last few quarters, their revenue has increased by hundreds of millions, and they're actually borderline profitable now. So they should be reporting a profit this year.
The estimates are for a profit. Did you read any of the Capital Forum pieces that were out on the company a month or two ago?
No, not from recently.
Okay, that I would encourage you to look at. I don't know where they are off the top of my head, but basically and I read them a long time ago and have since forgotten them. And we can do another one on Trupanion if you want at some point. But the Capital Forum put out some. They put out a couple of critical reports. I don't know off the top of my head.
Criticism, and a lot of people don't like the vets, you know, selling the insurance and this and that. But, you know, I don't want to talk about Trupanion forever because it's not my favorite topic. But we're talking about how do we find a stock, and how we find a stock is around the themes. And, you know, pet ownership and dogs is one of our themes here. It's not a major theme, but it's a theme we're playing. We're constantly looking for ideas. On my desk right now, I'm very happy to say I have cannabis products all over because we're looking at, you know, pot companies. And
Because you're getting high on the job.
Well, I'm not high at this point, but no, you know.
That's
listen,
your problem.
We try all the products. I got a Tesla Model 3, you know. We got plenty of people with pets here, and obviously I'm in Southern California where, you know, marijuana is quite popular. So I went to a MedMen store the other day in Venice, Abbikini. I mean, it's an amazing thing to see. These are also overvalued stocks. So we're looking at, you know, all the different pot companies in Canada. We're very big believers that the legalization in Canada and then ultimately will lead to federal legalization in the United States will bring mass acceptance to using cannabis as just like alcohol.
What are some of the names you're looking at in Canada and the U.S.? I don't know shit about the publicly traded marijuana industry, but just for the listeners, what are the four or five names you're looking at that
have made sort of our final list of being big enough and, you know, solid enough companies to really potentially buy. You know, the ones that list here make it easier, like Canopy and Cronos, which I'm looking very closely at this Cronos, which is very interesting. I do like MedMen. It trades in Canada. It's an expensive stock, but they're doing amazing things. And then we're also looking at Aurora, which is basically a big grower as well. So, you know, one of the things we found right off the bat was that there's going to become a total oversupply of marijuana in the next couple of years. Capacity is growing like crazy. And it, actually, the cost of
that would be great.
I know. The cost of growing weed is going down substantially. And, you know, right now it only costs $1 a gram. So when you go to a dispensary, you pay $10, $12 a gram. So that gives you an idea of the margins. That's why I like this business. And the cost per gram, and I just read in Israel, is 50 cents because they're so good at growing weed in Israel, I guess.
Well, maybe the weed sucks.
What?
Maybe the weed's just shitty.
No, this is like the super hydroponic, like high-tech weed, man. I mean, the weed today is like nothing like it's ever been in history. It's amazing, amazingly potent. They put so much science behind it. But mass production is going to cause falling prices, and so I think that's going to hurt the growers. So what we're really looking for are companies that have a more, you know, robust vertical integration with distribution, products themselves, retail distribution, as well as IP and other value that can be created, because I actually think the retail side is going to be better than the wholesale side. So we're still looking at these companies, and we put a lot of effort into learning as much as possible about companies before we invest in them. It's a hot sector, but, you know, we just think, you know, this area is going to grow for a long time.
Let me ask you a serious question.
Literally.
I'll ask you a serious question. Do you eat edibles?
I do, but I don't. You know, like, it's not.
All right, Bill Clinton.
No, I mean, like, I don't prefer that. I'm not saying I don't use pot. I do.
Right.
I just don't like edibles that much. So once in a while, you know.
They sneak up on you?
No, I'll eat one, you know, once in a while. But the truth is, you know, I much rather smoke pot if I'm just going to smoke. I'm old school, so I don't like vapes and all that kind of stuff, you know.
I'm with you on that.
But, you know, you're right. You know, I can go into one of these stores and I just can't even believe what I'm seeing. You know, it's like crazy how much stuff they have now. But I guess a lot of people do prefer edibles because it's, you know, you're not smoking, but it just has a different effect on you than smoking.
Yeah, it fucking sneaks up on you is the problem. What happens?
Well, I just go to sleep.
You're walking around minding your own business and, you know, taking your car to get washed, or you're on Jupiter, you know?
I play guitar and music, so I prefer actually being awake, you know.
Well, there's an area between conscious and unconscious that some guitar players go to. That's a different podcast for a different day, I guess.
Yeah, totally.
So I have
You know.
Go ahead.
Oh, go on.
No, go ahead.
Yeah, so anyways, the process starts with fundamental analysis. Also qualitative, where I'm going to the stores, I'm looking at the products and services, I'm looking at management. Right now we're doing a lot of background work on management because that's a big risk in the marijuana business. And what we found, like at Cronos, they have super professional management, a wonderful CEO with a great background, a UPenn law degree, you know, sharp guys, you know, real profit guys have gotten into this business, not just sort of drug dealers who have upscaled, you know. And so it's become a very interesting industry, and it's very early, but I think as we move forward in the next 5 years, you know, pot will be federally legalized in the United States, just like they just did sports betting.
I think you're right. Yep. I think you're right.
And these businesses grow. I mean, MedMen's going to be opening up a store somewhere on the strip in one of the casinos, which I hope it's in one of ours at MGM. And when you walk into a MedMen, it's like liberating. You're like, I can't believe this is legal like this in a nice store. I can just go buy marijuana. It's like, it's great.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy.
It's a long way from standing on the corner in the dark. You know what I mean?
Well, and I think it's becoming more socially acceptable too now, which is another thing. I mean, when I was in Vegas last year for Traders for a Cause with, I was talking to John Najarian about this, you know, and he was like, he was just telling me, he's like, you know, you just walk into one of these stores right here off the strip and you just buy the edibles and then you just eat them. There's like fucking nothing to it. And even last week I was on vacation and a buddy came down to Atlantic City and visited me. He didn't have edibles, but he had like some CBD gummies or whatever. And I was like, where the fuck did you get these? He's like, I bought them at Wegmans, which is the supermarket. And I'm like, what is going on? Like, this is crazy. You could just go out and buy the shit. But and I think that that's a self-fulfilling prophecy. I think as sentiment starts to change and it becomes, you know, as acceptable as drinking alcohol is, you know, the whole industry will change. It's going to be something to keep an eye on. But listen, I have a list here, okay, buddy?
Let's go into it.
Fucking like 40 questions that I've got submitted from people, and I tried
to go through them.
Well, I tried to root out the, like, you know, dickish ones and get to the ones that were, 'cause I don't want to be a dick. Nobody wins when you're a dick. But I do have a bunch of them here. So I wanted to ask you a few with, of course, with regard to Tesla, which is probably why everybody's listening anyways. We spent 40 minutes talking about everything else. So
pot, you know, which is a lot more fun.
Well, it is. Yeah, it is. Anyways. All right. So here is the first question. All right. The first question is, what would change your mind on Tesla? What would it take? What signs are you looking for?
Well, when you say change my mind, well, you know, certainly Elon Musk has tested, you know, everybody's faith recently. You know, I have the car now, so nothing's going to change my mind. The car is phenomenal. I love the car. Every part of it is beyond my expectation. I really tried to take a critical view of it when I got it. The whole process,
we're not talking about the product though. We're talking about as an investment. What would change your mind as an investment?
Right, but that's the whole point. It's the iPhone moment for cars, and it's literally the beginning of a life change of the way that we use transportation. So nothing's going to change. The only thing that would make me obviously concerned is if he can't execute. So if he can't execute, yes, that's a big risk if we're going to have to reevaluate the investment. But we're going to know that very soon, you know, in the next couple months.
Well, what would you be looking for over the next couple of months? Give me a scenario that happens over the next couple of months where you turn around and you change your mind on your investment.
Yeah, I mean, he just says, I can't get to 5,000 cars. You know, we're at 3,000 cars still, and well, now we're at 3,300, and we can't get to 5,000 cars, you know.
What if he gets to 5,000 cars and they're losing more money per vehicle than they were when he was producing 3,000 cars?
Well, we don't, you know, that's not the math that we have. So the math we have is that right now they're making $15,000 operating profit per car.
Right.
And now he's rolling out even more expensive versions of it. You know, he's rolling out the performance version, which is even more profitable. So he's clearly taking a strategy, which he's articulated, to make maximum margin on every car he's making.
But
right,
but I'm giving you a hypothetical. Hypothetically.
In the hypothetical, if it's like Snapchat, I think that's a concern. That would be a big concern. But we've done the breakdown of the car. The Germans did the breakdown. They came up with the same exact numbers we came up with. So when we get that kind of reinforcement, we believe our numbers are right. And so we think it costs $28,000 to make the car. Right now they're cycling up, so you have higher, you know, input capital costs. But in the actual operating performance, we're going to see increased margins the higher output they get. And 5,000 is kind of the magic number where they actually can survive and move forward in a profitable manner. So they have to get to that number And obviously Elon knows that. That's why he's doing everything he's doing right now.
But if they ramp to that number and the company's financials don't improve starkly as a result of producing at that rate, would that change your mind?
Yeah, and I think that we'll know that, as I said, probably not Q2 won't be a good example, but I think Q3 and Q4 for sure. You know, so the way I look at it is, and why I actually like the investment, is the short term is higher risk than the long term. You know, like, he has to get through the next quarter, let's say the next 3 months are just super crucial for them. And, you know, we're going to know pretty quickly, you know, if he's able to do that. I think the mistake would be to bet against this guy.
You just mean in general, or you mean for the short term, for the long term?
The fucking guy is crazy, man. He'll work.
Well, he is crazy, but is that what you want from a public company CEO?
Yeah, absolutely.
You want a literally insane person as a public company CEO? This leads right into my second question. Hold on.
I got 100 Tim Cooks running companies that won't do anything of risk. I got 100.
Yeah, well, Tim Cook runs the most profitable and most fundamentally sound company in the world.
Absolutely, and I've got that. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
I've got Bob Iger. I've got all the solid.
Oh, you mean you have it in your portfolio?
You know, conservative guys. You know. So I've got one crazy guy, but he reminds me of Howard Hughes, and if you studied Howard Hughes, you did pretty good.
Okay, so let me ask you this dovetails beautifully into my second question. Do you see anything unhealthy or erratic in Elon Musk's behavior?
Well, I'm sure people would say that about my behavior. So no. I think if you're used to normalcy and you want a guy who's going to go home every night at 5 and, you know, play with his kids and, you know, you're not going to meet a billionaire. You know what I mean? Most people, you know, I had an opportunity to meet Richard Branson, and he's super interesting, amazingly motivational guy. And he's crazy too, you know? I mean, totally crazy, really. And you meet these really successful people, and you'll notice that a lot of them are kind of crazy. I'm just saying.
I'm sure that some of them are peculiar. Yeah, I don't doubt that. Let's move on to the next question. How are you modeling the loss of the EV credit?
Well, you know, it'll be interesting to see how that pans out. You know, it seems like, you know, Tesla's trying to manage that EV credit as best as possible, but it will, and eventually soon. I'm not sure how many people are really buying it motivated by the EV credit, although the EV credit is awesome.
I don't know about that, right?
I don't know. I don't know how many people would not buy the car if there wasn't a credit, and I think we're going to see that over time. But I can tell you from my experience so far, I've had the car, let's say, a month. I've driven, let's say, 450 miles, and I've spent, like, $6. So, you know, I normally would have spent more like $180. So when you really think about the monthly credit you get by having an EV car, I mean, you're saving a lot of money right off the bat.
Well, it might not be material for you, but it might be material for other people that are, you know.
Yeah, but I'm just saying saving, you know, $150 a week for people is material. You know, a lot of people drive, especially in the cities, in traffic an hour each way to work, burning gas, you know, and they're using a tank a week, a lot of people, you know. So it's $4 a gallon in California. So when you look at your cost, $80 to fill up your tank every week, and then you take that away, you get an immediate benefit. And so as much as I like those tax credits, and that definitely brings down the price of the car, the real EV credit is pretty good.
But internally, in other words, you guys do not have an estimate for how many people are buying the vehicle simply based on the EV credit, and you have not modeled a scenario for the loss of the EV credit.
What we feel is that they will have unlimited demand, no matter what.
Explain unlimited demand to me.
So, like right now, they have, even if you cut their, let's say they have only 250,000 cars on order and not 500,000 that they claim. Let's just cut that in half. That would still take them a long time to fill. And a lot of people won't put their $1,000 down because they don't want to wait a year for a car. So if Model 3s were available like you could get it in like a month, I think demand would soar. It would soar for this car. And then the Model Y
That people are not putting money down on the Model 3 because they know they're not going to get the car for 3 months or 6 months?
Absolutely.
I don't know about that, Ross. I don't know, because
we've talked to a lot of people who said, listen, I need a car in the next 3 months, so I can't get this car.
When did you reserve your Model 3? How
2 years ago.
Right. And that's my point. The people that want this car, that are excited about the car, would have already made the reservation for it.
Right, but like I have a guy in my office who is on wait for a Model 3, but he needed a car like months ago, and the fucking guy's burning around. I don't know if you guys have Bird out there yet, but it's a nightmare. There are these electric scooters now everywhere. And
we don't.
And he's just like, yeah, thank God you don't. Wait to see this new thing that's coming around. And so they're like riding electric scooters everywhere waiting for their Tesla, but that's the exception. I've talked to a lot of people who are like, I would get this car. I need to get a car, but I can't get it. So what's the point? And I think, you know, it is a downer. Like, you want to order something, you need to get it within a certain period of time. I think that the amount of people that won't buy the car because of the loss of the credits would be offset by the amount of people who want to buy a car and get a car within a reasonable amount of time.
No way. Come on, Ross. Really?
Oh,
what do those numbers look like?
Have you driven one? I mean,
yeah, but whether or not I've driven a vehicle is immaterial as to whether or not you can tell me what the numbers would look like to back up the statement that you just made.
Well,
But I mean, what is guessing? What, 1,000, 10,000?
So, like, if I asked 100 people, let's say, who are ordering Teslas right now, what is the main reason you bought this car? How many would say the tax credit? It would be probably none.
Oh, no way.
Those people are buying the car because they want a Tesla.
No way. Yeah, but you don't think
that
you don't think
the fundamental driver of people who have waited 2 years to get this car is that they get to save $7,500 on taxes, which I don't even get.
The tax credit has been sold by the company as a reason to buy the car.
I get that, but like, I don't get that credit for another year, and I had to put out, you know, 11 grand to buy the car between all the payments and bullshit. So, you know, in my mind, even this tax credit, what's so good about it? I don't have it. I don't get it. I still have to buy the car.
So the answer to the numbers that you would use to back up the assertion that the amount of people that are not buying a car because they can't get a hold of it immediately will offset the amount of people that are lost as a result of the EV credit being lost is literally just being pulled out of nowhere.
But I think both statistics would be just postulation anyways. So we could argue about it all night, but we don't know a real number, and you don't have a real number any more than I do.
Oh, I'm not defending the bull case. I'm trying to figure out.
But going backwards, we also don't know if the government doesn't extend this moving forward.
That's a very fair point.
So I think it's hard to make decisions about those kind of statistics when they're so hard to really tell, and it's so hard to determine what our policies will be in the future.
Okay, so let's move on to the next question. Do you think it is healthy for Elon Musk to pick fights with regulators?
Well, I think that I've, in my experience with regulators, no, it's not a good idea. Mostly because, you know, of the way they think and the way they act. But I think that NTSB, and in the cases that the issues have come up with, you know, I find, you know, the government to be totally corrupt and full of crap. So, you know, I don't trust anything that regulators say or OSHA cares about. You know, there's so much BS. So I can see why he's taking the stance that he's taken, and in a lot of cases, these regulators have sort of backed off because they realize, you know, they're kind of full of crap. So, you know, I don't think it's the best approach.
Wait a second.
Let's talk about that. With the last couple crashes, and you know, you read these reports, and they do a thorough job, and I think they've been fair, actually. with their reports. But I think that it's
that's very different than being completely corrupt and them realizing that their own reports are crap, which is what you just said prior.
No, I'm just saying in general, regulators have a lot of different interests that motivate them, and I fundamentally, you know, how would I say, even if you just read this recent FBI thing, you know, I mean, God,
what interest? So you think that the NTSB and the NHTSA, as an arm of the Trump administration, have an agenda to go after the company?
Absolutely.
Okay, so you.
I think that anything involved with the Trump administration has an agenda that's being forced upon them, whether they even like it or not.
What does that mean?
So I think the government's totally corrupt. So the last thing I care. So all you have to do is hire good enough lawyers, and they go away. Because they usually don't have much.
You mean all Tesla has to do is hire good enough lawyers?
Yeah, all Tesla has to do. You know, it's the stuff that goes on. I don't want to talk about it on this podcast, but the stuff that goes on between governments and regulators and business in America is ridiculous.
Well, let's talk about it on this podcast. I mean, that's why you're here. You're not going to offend me. I mean, I understand how what goes on between government and regulators and lobbyists and people of power. I mean, I'm not new.
So, right. So, you know, right now the oil guys are saying, oh, God, if Tesla's too successful, that's definitely going to hurt my car dealership. It's going to hurt my gas station. It's going to hurt my shale gas. It's going to hurt my coal jobs, you know, and, you know, it's a game.
So you are buying into the conspiracy. You think, well, the theory, I won't even call it a conspiracy. Well, I guess, yeah, it would be technically defined as a conspiracy. The theory that there is a conspiracy to stop the company.
Oh, for sure. I mean,
and you believe
100 years the oil industry has built America. I mean, look at go back to the Industrial Revolution. You know, it was predicated on oil. The Gettys, the most powerful families in America, were raised from oil and steel.
Yeah, no. I don't doubt that. But what I'm trying to...
So this is fundamentally like totally taking apart, you know, generations of a system.
If General Motors and Ford, but if General Motors and Ford and Audi and Jaguar and BMW and Porsche and all these other companies are going into electric vehicles, why is Tesla the target of this conspiracy and not these other companies?
Because they don't want to go into electric vehicles. They're only doing it because Tesla forced them to. They would have had electric vehicles years ago. They invented electric vehicles 45 years ago. So we would have electric vehicles if these companies wanted to make them.
So
Tesla forced the hand. So they're coming out with all these cars, and trust me, if they had their way, they wouldn't be doing that.
But
they would just keep making trucks.
Right,
margins on.
Why go after Tesla now if the damage has already been done?
Well, at first they were in with Tesla. You know, Mercedes and Toyota were the major investors in Tesla at the beginning. And I used to think when I first bought Tesla that Mercedes was just going to buy Tesla. And I had, you know, pretty good information that Mercedes was going to buy Tesla. And,
well, it wasn't that good because it didn't happen.
Well, right, because something changed. They decided to divest themselves of this investment. They had made money on the investment. Toyota decided the same thing and decided to go their own way. And I'm not really sure why, but, you know, Tesla has grown and grown and grown, and they're an existential threat to everything they stand for, just like Netflix has destroyed the valuations of Comcast and Time Warner and Disney. That's what Tesla's doing to GM and Ford.
So when the NTSB comes out and says something like a vehicle accelerated, you know, prior to crashing, do you accept that, or do you think?
Yeah, I accept that, and I know why it happened because I use autopilot. See, when autopilot's engaged, you can set a speed, and if you're following behind another car, it will keep an exact distance behind the car that you set, one car lane, two lane, three car lanes. If that car pulls out of the way, the car will automatically speed up at a speed that you've set on autopilot. So if it doesn't see something in the road, like a broken mid-piece that's in the road, and especially where it's troubling is autopilot isn't really good yet at determining if the lane lines are separated.
Well, shouldn't that be a problem? Shouldn't people not be allowed to use it then if it's
really
good?
No, autopilot works amazing. Like, I use it every day.
Well, it's driving people into medians that are in the middle of the road.
No. Autopilot has driven one person into a median.
I think autopilot has driven
cars on
that.
The road.
Whoa. You want to check that fact? One person?
Well, whatever.
I can think of...
Maybe
well,
two?
It's not
maybe
whatever.
Two?
It's not whatever.
I don't know if I buy the story from the woman, you know, who was on her phone. And
well, there one
attention.
One woman got driven into the back of a fire truck.
Because story makes me more concerned because...
Wait, hold on one second. There was the guy who was touring in Greece whose car slammed into the median in Greece.
Then there was
the guy in California whose vehicle slammed into the similar type of barrier. What happened was I think somebody pulled out from in front of him, and then the highway, there was an exit lane, and he was in a lane that could have went straight or could have turned into an exit. And it was obviously, I mean, it's very obvious that the software has trouble with that.
Once again, I use it every day. I can tell you everything that works with it and everything that doesn't work with
well, I'm just asking you now.
So yes, autopilot can be very dangerous if you're driving 75 miles per hour, you're playing on your phone, and I'll give you an example. On the drive to Santa Barbara, when I was using it, the highway becomes two lanes. And normally, when you're in the fast lane, there's no exit. But there's a couple places in Santa Barbara where the exit is actually on the other side, on the fast lane side. And, you know, I'm coming around this turn, and you see this, and then the lane kind of splits. And, you know, you can run right into the median if it loses where the lane is, you know. So that's why you're supposed to pay attention, because I'll take over autopilot, like, probably once or twice on a, you know, 45-minute drive, you know, because, like, cars will be doing something wacky or something will seem a little weird. And when you're going 75 or 80 miles per hour, you're supposed to be paying attention. And it's very clear that you're supposed to be paying attention. And so autopilot isn't perfect, and it's clearly not perfect. You see what I'm saying? It's not like...
I do.
So what it does phenomenally well is if you're just, like, driving on the highway on a normal set of conditions without, you know...
Turns or exits.
No, turns are fine. Exits are fine. Changing lanes are fine. I would say the scenario that it can't do well is, like, PCH. So Pacific Coast Highway, I was trying it on, and I had to take over all the time. There's literally stuff everywhere.
Well, what is stopping... Yeah, but my point is, what is stopping people from you know, using it on Pacific Coast Highway? If you're saying it doesn't work on Pacific Coast
because
Highway...
Because you have your life in your hands. Like, why would you not pay attention
I'll tell
to driving?
I'll tell you.
I mean, it forces you to pay attention, too, because it'll beat them stuff.
I'll tell
but
you.
I'm just saying, like...
Because when...
Like, when you're driving a car...
At the Model 3 handover event, the CEO, Elon Musk, stood on the stage and said, in the future, and then said, the future being now... With autopilot, these cars are all equipped for fully autonomous driving, and that you can do whatever. You can sleep, you can read a book, you can do whatever. And that, in my opinion...
That I believe you'll be able to do very soon.
Yeah, but that is very different from the CEO saying you can do it now at the Model 3 event, and that is why people are engaging this thing and... texting on their phones.
Well, I think he's made
book.
It very clear that you need to be engaged and you need to be safe.
I
think he's made it very clear about that. And,
well,
I think it works amazingly well. I really do.
Unless you're on Pacific Coast Highway.
I put both my kids in my car. I go 75 on autopilot with them. But I pay attention. It's my life.
I understand, but you don't think that... So, in other words, to you... The autopilot function hasn't been marketed in any type of deceptive manner at all, nor is the software anything less than road ready, is what you're saying.
I'm saying that I don't think it's been marketed deceptively. I think there's tons of warnings. When you pick up your car, they do a whole thing about what you're supposed to do and not do about auto. You know, they have an actual class that you take before you get your car for about 30 minutes where they run through how autopilot works and what you're supposed to be doing and not doing with it, which I'm sure you haven't been to. And so, you know, they're very clear when you get your car what you're supposed to be doing. And the other side of the coin is when you're in the car, it gives you warnings if you're not doing what you're supposed to be doing.
Well, what about in the case of the gentleman, the Apple engineer who died?
I think he had fallen asleep.
But hold on one second. Wait. Excuse me. I want to go back and I want to talk about the warnings, right? In that case, the NTSB found that he was warned something, you know, far prior to when the accident occurred, and not any time immediately preceding the accident. So what say you on that with regard to your...
So this is the risk. So if you want to know the truth of the risk here, is that it works so good that you become very comfortable with it, and it's very easy to fall asleep. You know, if you're tired and you've been working all day and you're driving in the dark and you're used to autopilot, you trust it. And I think that's the risk, that, you know, you just get so confident with it that you do start playing with your phone. Because when you're actually not driving and you're sitting there, you become almost like a passenger in your own car.
Well,
and you're sort
exactly
of like,
what
am I doing?
Going.
And you're sort of like, what am I doing? I'm just sitting here listening to music, which is nice. But then you like want to fiddle with your phone, or you want to do something, because it's so good that you get confident with it. And I think that's the risk, is that it's good enough that, you know, you really can pretty much fall asleep, but it's not 100%. And I think that's the risk.
Well, then you can't fall asleep.
Yeah, like you can easily fall asleep, but then you're definitely, there's, let's say, a 5% chance. It's not 99%. You know, it's not. I wouldn't say it's 100% working. It's not 99% working. I'd say it's 95% working. So it's like there's enough risk.
Is 95% good enough to be on the road?
And to be
called autopilot? You think the people?
Oh yeah, for sure. And what you find when you're on autopilot is you can see all the dumb, irrational drivers around you doing stupid stuff that they would never do if it was on autopilot, because autopilot doesn't let you do stupid stuff. And here's the funniest thing: so, my wife actually really prefers autopilot over me, and so, like, she's like, just put it on autopilot. And then the minute I go off autopilot, it gives you warnings when you drive too recklessly, and so it's always like warning me that I'm driving too recklessly.
You reminded me of the airplane. You know the movie Airplane with the autopilot, the fucking inflatable guy that pops up.
Totally. And it's like, it's so funny. And my wife will like literally like hates driving with me, and she's just like, put it on autopilot, because like I don't want to deal with it, and I don't want to argue with her. And I was like, I've never crashed in my whole life. You know, like give me a break. But the car has all these warning features when you drive too fast up on a car or you do something stupid. And so it's like always warning me that I'm driving recklessly, you know. So, it's pretty funny. So the car drives really well too. You know, it's a very fast car for, you know, what you would think. And so it's like, it's very pleasant to be on autopilot. It's very pleasant not to argue with my wife, and it is much safer than when I drive. There's just no question.
Okay. Let's get to a couple more questions. Thank you for answering that. These are some ones that you'll probably be able to sort through quickly. This guy is just asking, you mentioned on Twitter that you couldn't wait to buy on a break of 300 and you had 35 million in dry powder. Did you put it all in at that level?
No, I did not put all 35 million. We have 40 now. No, we buy for clients who either don't have the stock or don't have a lot of the stock when it gets down there. But we manage portfolios for people, so it's got to fit in where, you know, the money is going. You know, so if somebody gives me $1 million, I might put, you know, let's say 30,000 or 25,000 in Tesla. And so what we put to work, when we see stocks drop and we have an opportunity like we did today to put in something to work, we'll put it to work then.
What did you put
so
it
we
to work
we were able to put money to work when the stock had dropped and you know.
Today,
it,
you mean?
It was a lucrative experience.
You bought today?
I didn't buy Tesla today. I actually didn't buy much today at all.
Okay. So you just mean a correction in general today.
Yeah.
Okay.
But like, we were looking at some other stuff.
Ross, as a holder of Tesla equity, how do you think about, this guy's trying to say, what do you think about what Elon wrote to those who were being laid off recently, specifically the line, profit is obviously not what motivates us. Please answer with your finance hat on, not your environmental hat. Thanks.
I thought that it was great because, you know,
I knew you were going to say that.
No, because I think it took this experience for Elon to understand, reality. And the fact that he finally recognized this reality is very important, because I think he became very comfortable with the fact that very, very wealthy investment firms will fund his dream for an unlimited amount of time. And so he clearly was spending excessively, like on staff, for example. He clearly wasn't taking timelines as important. He clearly had delegated too far. You know, this whole experience, you know, you really see the mistakes he made. I mean, he made mistakes. That's why we are where we are. And that's why they're short sellers. And it's not like the short sellers are 100% wrong.
Hey, take care.
It's that he made mistakes and he's had to adjust. So to see that he's actually understanding what he needs to actually do, I thought was really positive. I'm glad that it shocked him into realizing he needs to make a profit and not just focus on making as many cars as possible. I think he had the Amazon mentality and he needed to change to be, you know, and I think this pressure has forced him to think like a better business person. And I think that's good.
Okay, next question. Why would Elon keep buying stock during the most illiquid times in the market? And doesn't this seem like manipulation? I think this person's asking about him buying stock pre-market, which I think he was found to have done a couple weeks ago.
I think smart CEOs buy their stock when they think it's the best opportunity to buy. You know, I was looking at that Jamie Dimon trade the bottom.
Yeah, but wait. You're missing the point. I'm asking, why is he buying stock in the pre-market session when there's no liquidity and it's easier to move the stock higher? What's the advantage to him to buying stock?
He actually is buying in the pre-market. When you buy,
I think he was. I think he was found. I think somebody went through the tape and actually took the Form 4 and compared the Form 4 to the tape for the day and found that he was buying in the pre-market.
I don't know how you fill 72,000 shares of Tesla in the morning.
I don't think he. Well, I think there is liquidity in the morning to some degree. I'm not sure if he filled the entire position.
Not 25 mil. I think that's an institutional trade.
Wait a second. Let me just say this. Let's say he was found to have bought in the pre-market. Why would he have done that?
I wouldn't.
And by the way, just so you know,
a great indicator of anything.
Well, just so you know, first off, the stock's traded 77,000 shares so far after market today, and it's only 5:43 p.m. here. So he could ostensibly have bought 77,000.
Yeah, that's like the whole market of that whole thing.
There's 2 hours left in the aftermarket session. I just want to address that one point. I think it's possible, number one. I don't think he bought the entire position pre-market, but I think he bought some of the position pre-market. And I just want to know, what is the benefit of doing that other than it is easier to, because there's less liquidity, possibly move the stock up?
Well, you're not, because it's pre-market. So whatever those opening trades are in the morning on the exchange is going to move the stock right off the bat. So, you know, we find very little correlation to like what a stock closes at the end of the day to what it was doing pre-market. You know, there is some, but
don't you think that pre-market movement in a stock, just like futures moving for an index, can be a shift of sentiment?
Not really. I mean, maybe.
Oh,
briefly,
come on!
You really think pre-market trading matters?
Absolutely,
that much?
Absolutely.
I don't pay any attention to it. Actually.
Well, CNBC does, Seeking Alpha does, major news source does.
People trade. They got to talk people into trading.
Yeah, but if you don't think that a company is marked up $5 pre-market for no reason can affect the sentiment for the way it's going to open, then that's crazy.
No, I think you wanted to affect the sentiment by buying $25 million worth of stock and putting that out there, because I look in the Wall Street Journal at how many CEOs bought $25 million worth of stock in the last few weeks, and it's pretty few.
Why would any CEO buy their stock in the pre-market session on the open market?
I mean, I'm not convinced that it was meant to manipulate anything.
Why not wait until the open, until there's liquidity?
Because I'm not convinced that that actually happened.
Well, let's just say he trades
with an institution, so he's buying through an institution. He's not buying like on Schwab.
Let's just say it did happen. Let's say I'm right and it happened. Why would any CEO do that?
I would have no idea. I would think that you would want to get the best price possible for the stock.
I'm going to look here. Let me see if I can just find it right off the top of my... I should have been prepared with all this shit, but I didn't. So.
Well, I mean, I don't think you can actually tell in the actual SEC filing when he bought the stock.
Yeah, you absolutely can, because it gives
you...
It
has a date and stuff.
Yeah, but it'll give you like a volume-weighted average price. There's a way to do it, and somebody did the analysis. I just don't have it in front of me. But anyways, okay, so let's move on.
Yeah, it might be a tad of over-analysis, but let's move on.
Or, you know, it could just be analysis.
It could be, but maybe we're overthinking something. I mean, he's trying to force the stock up. There's no question. So I think the issue,
from
my perspective, is he bought the stock, whether he bought it in the open market or pre-market, he's trying to make the stock go up. That's why you buy a stock. And so he knows, as well as I know, that, you know, here the stock's under pressure, and he wants to show confidence. That's why CEOs do this.
Okay. All right, let's see.
And he made some money, too.
So far, he has. You're right about that, just as you have as well. Okay, let me just go through these and try to root out some of the duplicates. Do you have a...
More minutes, yeah.
What's that, buddy?
I just have about 5-6 more minutes.
Okay, cool. So we'll do like one or two more, and then we'll just wrap it up.
Yeah, sounds good.
Okay, this person is asking, do you have a price target to exit or scale back your Tesla long? Or is it a buy and hold until whenever, 2025, 2030, whatever? That's the first part of the question. Do you have an answer for that?
Well, you know, from my perspective, Tesla's a 10-year investment, sort of like private equity. But, you know, if things change along the path that we don't like, we might reassess that. But right now... we just need Tesla to get to their goals. If they can get to the 5,000 cars, we think the stock is worth, you know, $100 billion. So, you know, the first target for Elon is 100 billion market cap, 20 billion revenue, and 1.5 billion EBITDA. That's what he's shooting for. That's what 5,000 cars a week for 12 months will get him. So I think that's the real first goal step that we're looking for, is to see the stock get to 100 billion. And I think that can be achieved, you know, possibly in the next 12 months if they're able to hit their numbers.
So, okay, the last question I'm going to ask is this. I would love to follow up on that, but in the interest of time, I don't want to waste your time. Here's the final question. How big is the market for the $50,000 plus Model 3 in the United States pre and post fit credit, and elsewhere in North America or in the world? How big is the market for the car, and where can we go to find statistics about the total addressable market?
You know, when you're talking about the 50,000 plus car,
right?
Value. I mean, I'm sure there's some statistic on how many cars are sold for $50,000 or more. But I'm going to guess it's at least a million a year or more.
Have you looked at the total addressable market for the vehicle?
I mean, but we're looking on a global level, so that number is very big. But like,
how big is it? I think on a global level.
Well, you know, in China, you've got probably twice the size of the EV market that you have in the United States right now. You know, so that's a very important market for Tesla, and one that I know they're addressing
on a dollar basis or on a product volume basis.
I think we do 17 million cars in the United States. So let's say of the 50,000 plus, let's say that's, I don't know, 5 million cars, and Tesla could take 20% of that easily. So, you know, that's a million cars a year. If you add in China, that could be 2 million more cars a year. But any way you look at it, Tesla's a company that will be making a million cars a year at some point.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll leave it there. Listen, Ross, thank you so much for your time. I know we probably ran a little bit longer than you thought we were going to. And
we always do.
I appreciate you letting me play the counterpoint and the counterparty and the civil discussion, as always. And hopefully, I guess also I'll extend you a congratulations on the Tesla you bought recently in the high 200s. Maybe we'll check back in a couple months and see how things are going and go through the whole thing again.
Yeah, and I appreciate your time, and I'm going to have to go reassess my, my Netflix long.
I would suggest you do that.
Take an edible and really think about it. I try not to mix. Well, I do mix Netflix and edibles at times, but you know, I do appreciate the tough questions as well. But I do have to say that I've been driving the car, and it's a phenomenal car. And I think you should try it. And I think if you really try the car,
I don't doubt that the car is phenomenal. It's fast.
Yeah, but that's a very important thing. You're just disregarding.
Well, it is or it isn't. If I give the car the product of the doubt, and I say that the car is a game changer, right? And I love the vehicle, right? And I concede that point completely. What is that going to do for the way that I look at the company's fundamentals? For the way that I look at the company's financials,
how's that going to change
the company's balance sheet? How's it going to change their capital needs?
Well, I think the point that's most relevant is it scalable product, and can they scale it? And if they can, you know, they'll have plenty of demand. That's why I'm not worried about demand. It's can they scale? And I think, you know, considering you didn't even bring up the tent, you know, they're getting pretty desperate to scale here, so they're doing everything in their power to grow the business as quickly as possible now, and so we're seeing that stress. So, you know, the next couple of months are going to be pretty interesting and exciting for Tesla.
It's definitely going to be interesting next couple of months, and we'll have more answers the company reports. And I'd love to have you back on, man. I'd love to have you back on and run through
me.
It all again.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
All right, Ross. Talk to you soon. Thanks again.
All right. Take care. Have a good one.
All right, that was the one, the only, Ross Gerber, dialing in live from the left coast, where people are cruising around on little scooters, like he said, and everybody is highly evolved and chomping down edibles, including Ross. Well, anyways, I'll be back probably over the next day or so. I got a bunch of list of shit that I put together while I was on vacation that I want to talk about, but for now, there's an interesting way to get back to the QTR podcast. And hope you guys look forward to what I have coming in the future. And it is now officially time to go watch the Philadelphia Phillies. With that being said, I am out of here. Peace.